If you're looking for the foremost authority on politics, financial advice, or social issues, then boy are you in the wrong fucking place. But if you like dick jokes, tunes, and people punching each other in the face, then subscribe to Not These Two Fucking Guys podcast.
I'm Rock.
And I'm Archie.
Well, our opinions, they might not matter to some, but...
What are you doing in there?
It's a podcast!
Immature, crass, trashy. And those are their good qualities. These poor schmucks are a couple of IQ points away from eating paste. But when it comes to music, sports, and comedy, well, that's all they know. You're listening to
Not These Two Fucking Guys.
Not These Two Fucking Guys podcast.
Yo, asshole, I went to Target.
You went to Target 9:30 on a Thursday night, huh?
Yeah, that's why we're doing this running and gunning intro. Paper towels tied with Oxy. Because we got to get Oxy.
Do they give you money off your bill when you bring your own bags? Under your fucking eyes?
I look like
you look like a raccoon's cunt.
Yeah. So today I went to get, it was a gorgeous day, no?
Beautiful.
I went to go get the car washed, and I went to the one around the corner from my house, and I was running, you know, I was, again, running, gunning all day, bro. So I was in line, one person in front of me, and I bent, and I was just waiting. So I went on my phone, checking our social media, you know, doing all the stuff, and guess what? Ten minutes passed by. And I went, you know, I'm not moving. And I look up, and there's one guy servicing. Like, you know, that's at least a two-man, two-woman job, no?
Yeah, I mean, you got to fucking
vacuuming.
Vacuum, put the soap on, ring it up.
You're not a newbie. You know what's going on. Okay, there was one guy doing the cars, and he had one arm.
Get the fuck out of here.
I can't make sense.
The punchline better be coming.
He would put the match under his sleeve, under his nub, and then
like Jim Abbott.
He was like the Jim Abbott of car washing.
God bless him.
You know, I'm under a little bit of fucking, you know, time constraints during the day. Got to get back, and I said, "What the fuck is a one-armed man doing a 2-3 person job?" I felt bad for him for a second. So then I gave him another 5 minutes. Then I got out of the car and I went to the person behind me and I was like, "Yo, I gotta go. Get the fuck out of here. I can't be waiting." I was like, "This is too long, bro. Way too long." So
there's only one person in front of you?
Yeah. But yeah, it was too long. Like, he couldn't fucking, like, next thing you know, for about a good, out of the last 5 minutes I gave him, two of them, he was missing.
Cigarette break.
Not even joking around. He left. I don't know.
Come on.
I don't know, dude. It was sick. I didn't understand that. I was cracking up, but I wasn't laughing at the guy, obviously. But, like, I mean, you know, it's just a little fucking... little cum si cum sa that there's fucking a guy with one arm doing a couple of man jobs. I felt bad for him.
I gotta be honest with you. It is a little weird up by you. A little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely a little weird by me.
I stopped at this gas station. I think it was a no-name gas station. You know, it's kind of like, it was on that big main street. And the guy who came out, I'm waiting there for a second. The guy who came out, he was either the attendant or the guy who just killed the fucking attendant. He was coming after me. I'm like, oh, hey, yeah, put up regular. Please don't hurt me.
There is a gas station that I've frequently used. That's by a D&D by me. Quite some years ago, before I even knew I would be living where I live, I was with our mutual friend, Big Willie Style.
Willie Sludgehammer.
It was like a Maserati, and we were going, and we were fucking flying, and we were taking turns, and we stopped at a gas station. He got out of the gas station, and the gas station, I will never, ever fucking forget this as long as I live. The gas station, first of all, he was like, "Yo, we gotta go have a drink. I'm like, nah, I gotta go. You know that whole, you know all day, like, no, we're fucking having a fucking drink, like that type of thing. So we stopped for gas, and the fucking gas station attendant handed him a gallon of vodka to slug real quick. There was like a half of it. But first off, where the fuck does a gas station attendant have alcohol for you? We fucking pulled in to get gas real quick, and all of a sudden he comes out of your heart. You want to hit this? And I'm like, no. Like, I think it's a little fucking weird that, like, I'm getting alcohol from a fucking gas station attendant that we randomly just stopped for gas. So he's like, yo, Arch, you want to hit this? Like, take a swig. And I'm like, no.
Well, was it obviously a full service gas station.
So then I fucking grabbed it. I took a swig real quick. I was like, fuck it.
That's how COVID started.
That's the most bizarre thing ever. Anyway, I live around the corner from that gas station now.
What I want to know now is what we're going to do.
Yo, Arch.
What's up, son?
I've been waiting for this one for a long time.
Hell yeah.
And I'm going to try not to be a little fanboy about it either.
You might be.
I'm not going to lie to you.
You might be.
Yeah, it might be a problem, but...
All right.
I'm going to keep it professional. Founding member of one of our favorite groups, no matter what genre it is, of all time.
Yes.
The great Danny Boy of House of Pain and La Cosa Nostra.
What's up, bro?
In the Outsider's House Museum.
I can only say that because
we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, no doubt. That literally is my exit strategy, man. As incredible as it sounds, and as much as an honor as it's been to be, you know, a founding member in those groups and to have enjoyed an incredibly wonderful ride, I'm also very happy to be on this side of the world, doing what I do. But no doubt, you're here because of House of Pain and La Cosa, and so here we go.
Well, I'll tell you what, a lot of people can't. Obviously, this is only audio, right?
Yep.
But, yo, my man's view back here. Yo, Danny Boy's view. That's a nice little view, homeboy. That looks good outside the window. Out your window?
No, I live in a hotel. I live in a historic hotel downtown Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's called the Mayo Hotel. You see a glimpse of it if you've ever watched Rumblefish. When I first came to town, I definitely saw the big neon on the top of the building saying the Mayo, so I knew I recognized it. Mm-hmm. Never think in a million years I'd be living in it. We'll dig deeper into that as we go further down the road. But I tell you what, I pay a little bit less than I paid in Beverly Hills to live in a small apartment. So it's a fair trade-off, I'll tell you what.
Good to hear.
There you go. So let's start from the present. You talked about the Outsider's House, and I know a little bit of the backstory, how you were on tour. The house was for sale, kind of didn't work out. And then you wound up buying the original house from the movie The Outsiders. So let's start from there.
Yeah, sorry, I was thinking, so one, hold on, Mary, the food's ready. Two, I had to call DoorDash because we were going to go eat, but I'm running and gunning. So I was partially hearing what you said. You said about the house, and I can just tell you how this all worked. So
yeah,
started touring in 92 with House of Pain. What an incredible, run that was for us. The group breaks up in 98. I have no idea what to do with myself after that because I didn't have a B plan. And so I started getting heavily into drinking and then drugging and a downward spiral. It lasted about a decade. I pulled myself out of that, got sober, and started La Cosa Nostra. We actually started La Cosa when I was still using. But pretty soon after, that kind of fell apart before it even got started. Then I got sober and I retooled it and we put it together as the La Cosa that you know and where the fans know. And that brought me on my second round of touring. So I hadn't been on the road in a decade. So I can assure you the early 90s were incredible touring. You know, we were drinking. It was all fun, making a lot of money, mm-hmm. punching our way through, venue after venue. And then the party came to an abrupt halt. Again, a downward spiral lasted about 8 to 10 years. And then coming out with La Coca, it was a whole different, you know, vibe for me. And I was looking, you know, one, it was the gratitude of just being able to be on the road again, because I assumed in 92, like, yo, we ain't never going nowhere. This is forever. You know, I could get used to this, and I did get used to it. And then when you don't have that ability to do the, what you do anymore, or it all falls apart, you realize if you get a second chance at doing it, or I realized how important it was. And so on that tour, we ended up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we were playing Kane's Ballroom. And I guess the road manager at that time was talking to the owner of the club, and they started talking about the Sex Pistols and all the other bands that had played there. And my road manager says, you know, Danny's good friends with Jonesy from the Sex Pistols, man. And so the guy said, hey, come in my office. I hear you're friends with the Sex Pistols guitar player. I want to show you something. So he brought me in the office, and they had a whole that Sid Vicious allegedly punched out in 78, the only time that they had played the U.S., and they played the Kane's Ballroom before the last show where they break up themselves in San Francisco. And they had now redone the Kane's Ballroom, so they cut that piece out and they framed it in their office. So it's like, it's one of their like collections, That's dope. So I thought it was fantastic. I took a photo that day, and then it occurred to me, I kept thinking, Tulsa, why does that sound so familiar? I was like, oh shit, I think The Outsiders was filmed here. And so I was able to ascertain that not only I figured out that it was, but I was able to ascertain that the drive-in still existed, and that it wasn't far from downtown. Mm-hmm. And then a little further investigation, I found an article and a website that told me where the park from the movie was, and I realized if I could find the park, I could probably find the house. Now, 2009, Tulsa looked a lot different than it does now. Tulsa is the gem of the Midwest. I don't know why I hadn't found it sooner. It really is the Paris of the Midwest. It's a beautiful place. And, you know, I can give you a million reasons why, but before I do that, I'll just tell you, I got here for the first time in you know, 20 years of touring. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was home, and I never felt, you know, in all the places I've been, I had a lot of good times at a lot of different places in the planet, but I was always like, LA is my home. And this time I just had this weird connection to the place. And so once I found out The Outsiders were filmed here, I was like, oh, my mind was blown. So I go to the drive-in, I go to the house, and then I go to the park, and then I find the house, which was on the same block. You know, you can see it from the actual park. If you don't know the movie, the park, there's a pivotal scene.
Yep. Yeah.
Where Ralph Macchio's character, Johnny, ends up killing a Soch defending Pony Boy. So as a kid, I saw that movie as a 13-year-old. I was a latchkey kid, father in prison, and you know, a single mother who was mm-hmm. trying to raise a kid. So I was pretty much left to my own devices. So at 13, I walked in the movie theater, 13 or 14, saw that movie. And, you know, those were my dudes. And I pursued that kind of thing for the rest of my life. And this is how we end up in gangs and bands and crews and graffiti, whatever that I always liked. That was really the draw to hip hop to me, is that it was always like a team thing, where rock seemed to be like an individual experience. But, you know, anyway, so I find the house, I take a photo out front of it, and I post it on Facebook. And at that time, Facebook was a new thing. We were all still on MySpace, but, I posted on MySpace, and the reaction I got between the Sex Pistols hole in the wall, the Sid Vicious hole, and the Outsiders house was bonkers. And I don't know if you remember back then, but 10, 11 years ago, man, when I look up my memories on Facebook, you could post like free money, come see me for $100 bills, and you'll get like two likes. Like, nobody, you were stingy 10 years ago with the likes. Now we just program to like everything that we like that comes through. Anything that's visually stimulating or something that somebody we like personally, even if it's mediocre, we just like.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a support mechanism. But 11, 12 years ago, we were stingy as a you know, with the likes. But I put that house up, and I swear I must have got 150 likes, which was like mind blowing. Because prior to that, I might have got two or three likes on what I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I thought, man, I'm on to something. And so I used that tour bus in 2009. Kind of like a time machine, man. Every city I went to, I looked for something that was like pop culture, historical, worthy of, you know, getting off the bus on the day off and running around town looking for it. Mm-hmm. And then with the little bit of Photoshop skills and mashing photos, I was able to go, you know, to the grassy knoll. Or when I got to New York, I did the Summer of Sam. I started finding locations where he had committed crimes, and doing that by looking up on, you know, Google some articles or old newspaper footage or old, you know, YouTube footage of interviews. And I started to put that on the internet, and it became a thing. So it's now known as the Delta Bravo Urban Exploration Team, and we do that religiously. There's pages on Facebook where you can find us, and Instagram as well, and There's people from photographers to cops to other band members to you name it, a little bit of everything in there. And we really like hip hop historians, pop culture historians, you know, movie historians, you name it, anything that's in, you know, in that realm of pop culture. If we get a before photo, we'll go find the after and we'll tie it together and show you where that is. And
that's cool.
It turned
I like
into
that.
This beautiful little click and hobby. So never thinking in a million years that I was going to come back to Tulsa and end up buying the house, but that's exactly what happened. So LaCocca brings me out on the road again for the first time ever. And then every year we're touring, every sometimes twice, three times a year, we're going back and forth across the U.S. And then I also get in the travel bug affliction where I start to realize, like, you know, I'm 40 years old at that point, and I start to, like, go, hey, man, like, you know, I had been, like, on timeout for a decade on drugs, man. I was a prisoner of my own making, you know, on with the drug thing. So I'm now 15 and a half years sober. But that first LaCocca tour, maybe I had a couple, thank you, I had a couple years sober. For a dead man, I had a, you know, like, I had a, the attitude, like, I should be dead, and I'm not. So let's take care of the shit you want to do and look at it with different eyes. So everything I had saw in the 90s on the first round of, like, you know, endless touring, I needed to re-see with new sober eyes. And that's exactly what I did. I saw that and a million things beyond that. Mm-hmm. So I began traveling with earnest. And every year I would come back to Tulsa to make a pilgrimage to that house, which started the whole travel, Delta Bravo thing. And every year I'd come back and I noticed the house was a little bit worse for wear. I also want to tell you, when I first found that house, I couldn't believe it was still in existence, and neither could anybody
right.
else.
Yeah.
Anything in LA, New York, you know how it is. Like, we tear the shit down, or where it gets, you know, redone and it doesn't look anything like it. And
yep.
it just, and then the trifecta in that is there's the Christmas Story house. There's the Field of Dreams. I think there's, like, a barbecue stand from one of those slasher movies, the like Texas Chainsaw or something. Mm-hmm. These are starting to become things, but they're really not as easy as you think. And I can give you an example. So I'm a Fast Times at Ridgemont High fanatic as well. My collection is pretty massive of all of the stuff that you could imagine, or you probably can't imagine, that I have the Fast Times at Ridgemont High. With the exception of wardrobe, nobody has any wardrobe to my knowledge. And I know the lady, Marilyn Vance, who did the wardrobe on that, she said that they didn't think much of that movie. They returned all that stuff to Universal. So, and then Sean Penn and a lot of those dudes, they brought their own clothes. So who knows? But my point is, the house that Phoebe Cates scene takes place in, it's Stacy's house, the pool.
Yeah.
It just got listed on the market at $750,000. Now, even if I had $750,000, I can assure you, nobody in that neighborhood is going to fucking, you know, like the, they're not going to let you make a museum. That's just committed to that.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't either. I got to be honest. I'd be like, I love the movie too, homie, but if you try to make this a museum, I will sue you, because my kids are not going to get any sleep. If you got fans coming trying to see Phoebe Cates' titty pool, you know, or whatever.
What a great scene. Great.
Oh, my God. Listen, if you Google Fast Times pool drone, you will see my video from, like, 2006, where I threw a drone over the house with the help of a friend, and we got the shot via, you know, spying on the lady's house with the drone, because she wasn't going to let nobody see it. So
yeah,
Google
yeah.
that if you got the interest.
I will.
The great thing is that you really have to find those three things. You have to find something that's worthy of people, like, wanting to come visit. So the Outsider's House, the Christmas Story House, the Field of Dreams, those are all worthy.
Yeah.
Christmas Story Houses were located in a really bad part of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. So any addition to that neighborhood was a total thumbs up. For the Outsider's House, it's in North Tulsa. The neighborhood is downtrodden and underserved. So once I announced that I was doing it, we only had one person oppose it. We had to do a few different things, like build a little parking lot and get a bus. But other than that, we really had the support of 99.9% of, you know, everybody in Tulsa and everybody else in Oklahoma. And it's an addition to the neighborhood that's a welcomed addition, because when I got there, the grass was up to my knees. When I cut the grass,
damn,
the neighbors saw it, they cut the grass. And it had a beautiful ripple effect. And I'm going to tell you that just by the house being what it is, even when I just bought it and just was starting to work on it, everybody started to their house started to appreciate. They started to appreciate their house, and the values of their house are now double what they were when before I got there. Because mm-hmm. I've tried to buy a little house to be like, yeah, I might make it into an office, maybe crash out if I get bored. And houses used to be able to get over there pretty cheap. You're going to pay a lot more now. So
gotcha.
Anyway, I know I crammed a lot into that, but it took three. I bought the house at year five. I got to Tulsa, and I thought to myself, Danny, this house is not going to survive year six. And I don't know why I knew that, but I had that intuitive feeling, man, that like this thing kept bothering me. Like I like the outsiders, like probably like obviously more than the next guy does, but I don't, it's not like I like it more than Fast Times. They're equal in my book, or Stand By Me is up there with that, you know?
Yeah,
I didn't buy any of those things. This thing just called me. I don't know how to say that other than it may sound weird, but it was always in the back of my head. Like you need to check into that house. So for 5 years, I kept always thinking, I'd just be middle of the shower, go, oh shit, I wonder what's going on with that house, the outsider's house. Did they sell it yet? Is it still on earth? Has it been torn down? And so at year five, I started to get this weird feeling that it wasn't going to make it to year six. And so I started looking for the owner, and through a series of a few different events, we ended up getting a hold of the owner. I told her, listen, I know your house is off market. The first time I found it, 5 years ago, you were asking $40,000+ for it. If you ever had an inclination to sell it, I would love to hear your asking price. Not that I'm a buyer, but I'd love to know what the price was. And she got back to us with, she wouldn't take a penny less than $20,000. I had my buddy doing the negotiation because I would have offered her. And he ended up saying, we won't pay a penny more than $15,000, to which she accepted. So I bought the outsider's house for $15,000. At that point, I thought I had robbed somebody. When I got to the house, I bought it sight unseen. When I got in there, I realized that I may have been robbed and that I was in way over my head. I paid another $5,000 to relocate the tenants that were 8 months behind in rent. Then I basically screamed at the top of my lungs, like, oh, fuck, I am screwed here. So it was $20,000 into the coolest movie memorabilia that one could imagine. Mm-hmm. And the place was the house was just imagine a scene in Seven where they're hoarding and it smells like 3-day-old squid and there's rat shit, cat shit, bat shit. You can just imagine. It was no good. And at that point, I got the idea that, listen, maybe I could turn this into a museum. Originally, I thought I was just going to buy it and keep it from the wrecking ball because I felt like it wasn't going to make it. And then when I realized how bad the house's condition was, and then I realized I couldn't do anything with this house except for try to save it with the help of you guys, I put out the feelers and started a GoFundMe. And that's when I was like, we got to turn it into a museum. Yeah. And that began the journey, man. It took 3.5 years and I got help mostly from anybody from the local gardener in the neighborhood to chimney fixers, to roofers, to plumbers, to electricians, and all the way up to the author, S.C. Hinton, mm-hmm. and Jack White and Billy Idol helped out. And from rock stars to the author to just everyday people, man, we just kept on pushing. And 3.5 years later, we got it opened, and half of the cast has already been through, or a nice chunk of the cast. And then we had a beautiful grand opening. We cut the ribbon, and the mayor showed, and the lieutenant governor showed, and C. Thomas Howell and the Soch, and then COVID hit. So we've kind of just been on pause all of that time. And, you know, from there on out, this is what I do for a living. There's a whole bunch of House of Pain shit I'm sure you want to know, and whatever we can chop up that. But, I guess what I was trying to say at the end of the day, man, is like, you just don't know where life's going to take you, man. I wouldn't imagine in 100 years that when I walked in that theater at 13 watching The Outsiders, that one day I'd be living in Tulsa, Oklahoma as the official, groundskeeper, gatekeeper of that house. And that, you know, I bought that house. It had one poster. I had one Outsiders poster. Now we have the largest collection of Outsiders movie memorabilia, wardrobe, books on the planet Earth. And if I pride myself on anything, is that I'm a fantastic collector. And so in three years, I've been able to amass the collection that is literally back where it belongs in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So, I'm not a religious man by any means, but I'm a spiritual man. And I do believe that God has a plan, or the universe has a plan for you, despite your best or worst ideas, And so here I am, and I have nothing but good things to say about the people of Tulsa, the people of Oklahoma. They have treated me better than I've ever been treated in my life. And I get thanked a lot for doing what I've done. And I got to be honest, I need Tulsa more than Tulsa will ever need me. And so it's a perfect marriage for me. And it took what it took to get here. And I ain't going nowhere anytime soon. So
well, that's awesome, dude. I mean, you definitely found your calling. And you want to know what? You look like you got a fire in inside you. You sound like you've got a fire inside you.
It's a passion, man. I mean, I was telling my friend here today, I was like, you know what? I spent a decade in LA. Not that it was bad times. Again, I have a nice little circle of friends, you know, guys I grew up fucking idolizing.
Yeah.
I ran my motorcycle around. I got an old, you know, muscle car, lived in a nice little apartment in Beverly Hills. It was all great. It was all good, but I was treading water, and it just wasn't, no matter how much I made, I couldn't get ahead. And then if I wasn't making money, I felt like I was going to immediately be like on the breadline.
Yeah.
And the pressure of LA or New York, all that, it's like, it was immense, you know, and it was just hit or miss. And I didn't have a purpose. This house has given me a purpose, and my purpose is really to use it as an educational. We do more business even during COVID, which is crazy. But our business is more. I thought I was making a movie museum. What I ended up making was a book museum, because the Outsiders was written here by Nessie Hinton at 15 in 11th grade. She was failing English and got a D+ in creative writing. That book has went on to sell millions of copies. It's required reading for most 7th graders around the planet, but in particular in the US. And it sold more on the 50th anniversary than all the years combined, you know?
Yeah.
And so this house, we have students coming through Monday through Friday on student tours, less now because of COVID. Obviously it shut it down for a while, but now they're starting to come back. But prior to COVID, man, 3 days a week, I'd have 100 to 150 students a day on book scheduled tour who had just finished reading the book, would go to the Circle Cinema to watch the actual movie where it was actually filmed, and then come to the house and experience that firsthand. I mean, that's like a Willy Wonka experience. And that changes kids' lives, especially in an underserved part of the U.S. where we rank 48th lowest on the educational scale in Oklahoma. And that's a shame, you know?
Yeah,
and if I could be a little piece of helping kids like spark their fire, you know, I posted a quote today where Essie Hinton said something about like, if school taught me anything, it's like, you know, spelling and punctuation should not get in the way of you telling your story. And you know, she wrote the classic. She started the whole young adult category in 67 by writing The Outsiders. It was the first time in literary history that somebody was a young adult writing about young adults for young adults, and it creates the biggest category in books right now. That is the number one selling category, you know, in a large part in due to like Harry Potter and stuff like that. But that category starts here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, by a 15-year-old girl who was failing out of English and got a D+ in creative writing. Wow, if that don't spark some type of feeling in a student to be like, because I was that guy. I got a 9th grade education, bro. You know? And it's not about being book smart as it is to be, you know, to be engaged in what you're doing and passionate about what you're doing. So believe me when I tell you, I know you said it, you know, but I'm passionate about what I do because I wouldn't be able to do it if I wasn't, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome, bro. Listen, if you don't mind, I'm going to switch a gear for a second. I was telling Rocco the other day, I was like, listen, when he texted me that you were coming on, I said, in like 93, I sent my mom into the record store to get three albums because I couldn't buy them because I saved up money, but I wasn't old enough because of the parental guidance, you know, that shit.
Yeah, the tip of gore stickers.
Okay. Yeah. So, Raising Hell.
There you go.
Shout at the Devil.
Motley Crue.
House of Pain. Find all lyrics.
There you go. Nice. I ain't mad at that.
My mom looked at me and she thought I was a little fucking Murshad. She was like, what are you what are you sending me in to get? And I said,
there you go.
Just mom, just trust me. Just get it, please. She came out. I went home. I knew what I was getting with Run DMC. I only knew Jump Around. But the rest of the fucking album changed my musical taste in hip hop for the rest of my life.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, and I just wanted to let you know that. And I just wanted to ask you, making that album, did you know that we could talk a whole fucking podcast about Jump Around. I don't even want to get there. That whole album though. Did you know that making that album, bro?
I mean, yeah, I could tell you two things. One, the answer in large is no, nobody knew. Number two, the answer is yes, kinda, because at that time I was living on off of Melrose, which is like kind of like living in Lower East Side in a neighborhood that had a lot of like by CBGBs when it was popping. Like I was living right off of the spot where everybody from everywhere in LA would show up at Melrose just to walk up and down the street to look for girls, shop for clothes, you know, be seen and see people. So I lived one block up. So people used to come to my house all the time, and I had a very little, even before House of Pain, not for nothing, I had a little, you know, I'm a cult of personality type of weirdo dude who had a lot of, you know, dudes coming and going. We were doing a lot of little,
you know,
we were selling little drugs and doing a little bullshit. You were little knuckleheads. So I always had a steady flow of people. And those people back then, just like me, if the shit was garbage, if you were playing some shit, people would be like, get the fuck out of here with the shit. Get that, you know? And I put the demo on for Jump Around, and my own friends were wilding out. And we would play it over and over in my living room and go nuts. And I knew that this thing had like something different that these other, that just other songs didn't. And I was a music aficionado. I worked at a record store and was the product manager for a fucking year before, you know, I worked at the store for 3 years. So I was ordering product. I was in a store in the San Fernando Valley, which was a predominantly, you know, upper white middle-class neighborhood. And, you know, we had a lot of stars. Speaking of, you know, Motley Crue, like Tommy Lee used to live right up the block from my store. So he used to come in and I'd pull out the catalog and I would order him stuff like License to Ill or the video, the VHS version of the, you know, the tour. Because we wouldn't carry the store because we wouldn't have enough, you know, our buyers didn't know to buy any hip hop or to buy any reggae or to buy any, you know, I worked at the store at the time where you had to put Fishbone and 24/7 Spies and Bad Brains in the correct category. There was not even a rap category. They used to put rap in 89 and 90 in the R&B section. They were just like, they had no, reggae didn't have a section either. They put it in international music. So I know my music. When Eric went to work with Muggs, because we had made demos with a few other producers, with Quincy Jones' son, QD3, with this guy, Danny Saber, who's done a lot of rock classic shit. And then finally with Muggs before those three songs came out. Eric disappeared one day, went to Muggs's and met B-Real over there to work on it. They came back with Jump Around, Put Your Head Out, and Come and Get Some of This. And that thing was, I already knew at that point, we were off to the races. And but can I imagine that, what is it, almost 29 years later, that I'd be on a fucking telephone in Tulsa, Oklahoma, talking about the power of that song or that record. Again, I agree with you. And this is where I can remove myself from it and go, yo, that record was everything. And even for me, because it was our lives personified in that moment, that record took like 17 days to make. It took about a total of a month. But the writing that Eric did and the vibe that he encapsulated and the spirit that I put, we were doing logos simultaneously as you know, it was my name and my logo and my little like street click, the gang that we were running with, the Mickey Mouse Club shit that we were just, it just happened like in Muggs of Cypress thing was just starting to happen. And it was like cast in this 30-day process that just happened so quick. And then it changed our lives forever. And so, you know, I knew that it was a powerful thing, but I didn't think you just never know how far it's going to go. Because I got to also tell you that I did hear, I'm trying to think who, but even Jamalski, I don't know if you know who that is or you remember Jamalski. He was a Jamaican rapper that used to rhyme with KRS-One. And he had a song, it was called Jump Spread Out, that had that same kind of vibe. And it had LA and New York on fire in the clubs, but nobody outside of that era knows that song. So there were other great songs that had that kind of vibe, but just this one just kept going and going and going.
Talk about a song with legs,
a fucking anthem. So I mean, listen, I wish I wrote it because they're still doing quite fine on the royalty checks on those. You know, you get paid for the t-shirts, you know, when you're on top of the world, and I made a fortune with the merch. Those guys got the publishing, and so what I made with merch, they've long since caught up. But you know, we all made millions of dollars back in those days, or you know, we all made $1 million in the 90s, which is a lot of money back then. It's not a lot in today's world, but you know, when you're 21 years old, you have $1 million in your back pocket, you know, and you're headed. Prior to that, I was heading for a pine box or a 6x9, you know, in Folsom. So believe me when I tell you that record saved my life. It also almost cost me my life, because when you make a record at that age, at least for me, it arrested my development. So I thought that, you know, I could keep acting and keep behaving like I was and have no penalties and no repercussions in life. And I found out the hard way at 28, 29, when it all fell apart and the spigot, you know, the faucet stops pouring out that kind of, you know, money, and then you got to go look for a job. So I was an egomaniac with low self-esteem, you know what I mean? It's like, I couldn't work at Starbucks because what if you recognize that you're like a fucking chimp? You know, you keep hearing the baby please you work for UPS shit in your head, and that's ego. If I was smart and humble, I would have took that job and I would have just, you know, started again from scratch. But I had to go a 10-year downward spiral in a pity party till I got, you know, humble enough to start over. So
yes.
But yes, did that answer your question?
I tell you what, like, Archie and I love merch, right? And back in 92, it was pretty fucking hard to get. There was no internet. There was no, like, unless you went to a show, it was so hard to like, find, you know, there's a couple, you know, where we grew up, there's a couple, like little rock spots that had like t-shirts and stuff like that, and like you'd maybe find a House of Pain t-shirt in there, like you know, stuck in with the rock stuff, but it was it's not like so accessible as it is today, where you can just go on, you know, go online, go to the artist website, whatever, what have you. But
no, of course, it's kind of what watered it down. Listen, when I was in seventh grade, a friend of mine used to come to school every other day with a new concert shirt on, and I was like, "Yo, bro, like, you went to the Who last night?" He's like, "No." I'm like, "Okay." 2 days later, he's got, like, you know, Rolling Stones t-shirt from the concert the night before. I'm like, "You went to Rolling Stones?" He's like, "No." He's like, "My dad's a silk screener."
Yeah,
like, silk screener.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what that meant. I'm like, "Silk screener?" And his kid Terry Alec is still, you know, I still run around, you know, I still see him on the internet. I used to run around with his brother's stuff back in the day. And finally, after a while, I was like, "What the fuck?" I was embarrassed to ask. If I said, "Bro, what the fuck is a silk screen and where are you getting all these shirts?" He's like, "My dad makes these shirts for these bands. They're bootlegs. And if there's any like irregulars or the registration is off on the screen, they throw them in a reject bucket, if you will. And I just go to his work after school every day and help him out. And I take some shirts home if I like them. If you want, come get them." I got mad concert shirts. I was like, "What?" So we went over. I went over there with him one day. I was like, "In fucking heaven!" There was a whole bin of shirts. Some of them they were just using to get the registration marks and everything correct. It's not like today where the computer lays out those screens and all that shit.
Yep.
Back then you had to do it by hand and eyeball it. So it could be a shirt with like the Specials on the front and like Rolling Stones on the back, which was even weirder because they were just using it as like a test thing. And his dad was like, "Take what you want." So I started taking it. And then right in my mind, I'm like, "This is great." Cause I used to doodle and draw all the time. And I was an artist. And even as a kid, I was hours just drawing. And so I was like, "This is what I want to do. I want to be a silk screener, you know?" And so my love for merchandising and graphics and has been with me since I'm a young kid. I grew up when Kiss was like the shit, and Joe Namath was like a bigger than football, and Evel Knievel was like, you know, the guy that was like, was the original cult of personality, or Joe, or Kiss. I mean, and so the branding that Kiss did and all that 70s type of shit, and the cereals that we had and all that. So branding was always my thing. So since prior to House of Pain and you know, I put the weed leaf on the hat. I had original weed wear as a streetwear. I made $170,000 the first year we did it.
Damn.
And I was just out of my trunk and, you know, selling weed hats. And you see them in the early, you know, I got pictures of the Beasties rocking it, Redman rocking it, B-Real rocked it in all the early promos, the thicker leaf, we rocked it. It's like, I made a fortune on merch. So merch has always been my thing. And literally, House of Pain starts because of an idea, a name, that it was on a demo for some other music that I was dabbling, just calling it music. And Eric seen it, and that name resonated with him. And then I designed the logo around it, and then we were all in. You know, that's always how I've done it. You know, I start first with an idea, and then I come up with a graphic and a logo that inspires people. And then from there, I try to sell you on the bigger idea, like, "Hey, let's just turn this into something." And so it's just always been my thing. But I, too, am a merch and what do you call it guy. And again, back in the days, man, there wasn't a lot out there for if you're a white boy and you're into hip hop and you were, you know, it was like, this was our thing. We try to do it like, okay, cool. We want to make a name and we want to do it on our terms. And we don't see any reason why, you know, we can't do it this way. So
Archie and I, like our friends, like growing up, it's like when you guys broke, it was like, holy shit. Like they're like, the music like spoke to us. Like it felt like you guys were making the music for us. It was like the weirdest, like most bizarre feeling.
It's funny you say that because Everlast said, "Yo, I'm gonna make this for Archie and this dude right here," and we're gonna. And I said, "You know what? I haven't met him, but I'm thinking 30 years from now I will." So okay, that's let's awesome. Make that for them.
And roll.
That's for you guys.
I tell you this though, two of the best shows that I've been to. This is the first time that I saw you. It's 1994. Korn and Biohazard were opening up for you guys at Rutgers in New Jersey. It's a college. It was an amazing show because just from the timing of it, you know, what it meant the first time, you know, me seeing you guys live, you know, you guys put on an amazing show. And then Archie and I, you know, bookending it, one another show. This was just the whole night. Cause me and Archie hadn't been out and, you know, getting older, having kids, you know, like hadn't been out in a while. Saw you guys at the Walmart Theater in Montclair, New Jersey, around the
2016?
Yeah, St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it well. It's funny you say that because I just did the small little part in a movie that just filmed here in Oklahoma. And my buddy Peter Green is one of the stars of it. He was also in the Fed Up mm-hmm. video. He's Zed from Pulp Fiction and a million other movies that you may know him from. But he was like, "Man, I feel bad. I haven't seen you. How long has it been? 5-6 years? I said, "Bro, it's been 15 years, man. I've been sober 15 and a half. I saw you right when I got sober." And he was like, "Man, that sucks because I was trying to come to that show." Montclair, was it, right? He was like, "My mother lives in Montclair, and I was there that night, and I wanted to make it there. I just couldn't make it." But and he reminded me of that show. It's crazy you said that twice in 1 week. But that was probably the last good House of Pain show, to be honest with you. We did a 30th anniversary or 28th anniversary. We took it to Europe, and then at that, me and Eric just couldn't get along, and it was just not good for us to be, you know, you just get to a certain age where like you just two different passing ships, man, because a lot of times have elapsed since, you know, we started doing that shit, and we've grown in different directions, you know, and yeah. It is what it is. I'm not faulting nobody for whatever it is, but it's just really hard when you're just like, you know, and so I just, there was a point where it wasn't worth it to me to keep feeling, you know, like, you know, you just got to weigh it out, you know? So that show, be honest with you, man, that was like one of the last where it was still felt like, and I remember literally after that show, Everlast, we got in the car and he was actually excited about that show and was like, "Man, it's good to speak to me. We've been doing this for a long time. It's good to be here. Good to be doing this with you." And then that vibe fizzled the next time we went out. So that was really, it was a very memorable show for me as well. So
real quick though, I mean, for us also too, it was like literally, you know, we got to see House of Pain two blocks from where we went to high school. Like, it was just like the whole evening just came together. We really had such an amazing night. Go ahead, Archie.
Now, House of Pain as a group would not tour or play without you. Meaning, like, you are House of Pain.
No, I think he tried to do a few dates without me. I don't know how it went. I wasn't there. But you know what? I my thing is this, man. You know, I don't like it. I don't think it's sincere for the fans to do that. You know, you should just knock it on the head and leave it alone. I wouldn't try to do it neither. You know, it's just disingenuous. That being said, it's kind of like if someone tries to, like, you know, replicate your idea It's easier said than done. So if you know, if that's what it's come to, I don't have to like it, but I accept it is what it is. I have moved on, and I say that with all due respect. Listen, I'll always love Everlast. Our friendship and the work we did, it changed both of our lives for the better.
Yeah.
I don't think he would disagree with that. It changed them as we knew them. You know, I don't know that we both were, and I'll speak for myself. I wasn't, although it might have seemed like, you know, all fun and games. When I look back at the shit I was doing back then, I was always seconds and inches away from getting really in a lot of trouble. I'll just leave it at that. I was doing a lot of knucklehead stuff and taking penitentiary chances, but thinking I was smarter, faster than every cop on the planet Earth and every drug enforcement agent and every task force. And we were just, I wasn't moving that amount, but I was doing multiple things that were, probably would have set me on that trajectory. A lot of my friends ended up, and you go to prison one time, and then it becomes a habit, and you start going down that road. And I was drinking and doing a lot of outside. So House of Pain plucked me from that, you know, and then, it bettered my life in ways that, you know, again, as you know what yeah. I mean? We're here talking about that part of my life. So it definitely, I never look back at it as like, you know, something that, it's only good, but unfortunately in the end, you know, people just grow apart, and no different than if I try to say like, you know, your girlfriend from high school, could you still be working with her full time? Yeah, it's like once it's done, and it's like that. Now that being said, who knows, man? People always say, well, if you guys break bread, well, you guys, of course, whatever. It's not, you know, I'm easy going, but I don't. There was a long time where I felt that without House of Pain, I may be nothing. You know, all my worth mm-hmm. was attached to being in that band. And that's what, because people still know me from that. And that's a fool's move. You know what I mean? No different than if you're a garbage man, I don't treat people, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. When you're done with your work, you're still you. And it took a long time to be able to separate like Danny O'Connor from Danny Boy, because I felt like you wouldn't like Danny O'Connor yeah. if he yeah. wasn't yeah, yeah, yeah. Danny Boy. You know what I mean? And I'm Danny O'Connor at this point. And I had to come to terms with that. That's had nothing to do with anybody else or any of that shit. And I'm at a part now where I laugh at that. I used to even think that I would be, I wasted so many years trying to cultivate an image and a thing, and it didn't work anyway. And it just wasted a lot of good time. Yeah. So, you know, my friendships are what make me a rich man with the people that I deal with every day. My being of service, you know, is where, you know, I have a purpose, and being responsible for a house and to make sure it stays open and to do what I do, that's enough. And I'm overpaid already with all the stuff that I've experienced and that led me to here. So I look back at all that as like an incredible ride. And I also feel like the best is yet to come. And so, you know, I'm always looking forward to the next thing. You know, we're making one more La Coca Nostra record for the books, just to get it, you know, to nice. Put a nice little 4-album set together. We'll probably hit the road next year as well to give it one more time, go around the planet again. And, you know, take it day by day, whatever comes, comes. But again, what a blessing it's been, you know, to look back. And this might sound weird too, but you know, I look on one hand about the, you know, when you're looking at like successful white rappers, you know, I'm pretty much going to call it, you know, Beasties, Third Bass, House of Pain, Eminem. And then there's a slew of, you know, that feel for that. Yeah. Let's say Vinny's not, or Ill Bill's not, or Slane's not, or, but it's at a different level than the critical, the radio success or the household, you know, name success. And, you know, and so that's a blessing to even be in that golden era, you know, capsule. There's a ton of great, you know, and it's not even a racial thing or whatever. I'm just saying, like, when people think of, like, white rap groups, we're at the, you know, and nobody.
Nah, yeah, I hear you.
I don't give a fuck who you are, you know what I mean? And so, and even I know, hey, listen, that was always my, like, they were always the reason why I was like, okay, I could do this because they're doing it. And I hope that, you know, they took us on our first tour, which was also crazy. We also got kicked off that tour because we were too crazy for them. Well, so, you know. All of this shit makes for a good book. Do. Someday I'll get the impetus to sit down and actually try to remember it without, you know.
Yeah, so getting too emotional, we're not going to take up too much of your time. This is a final question. And you mentioned before you were 15 years sober. Congratulations. And that's very inspirational to people out there that are listening to this, you know. Something that I always wanted to know, if you don't mind, just brushing up on real quick answer if you want. There was a point in your life, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, your group, X Supermodels, right? Yeah. All right. So like a little bit after that, something changed and you got sober.
Yeah, I got caught blowing a hobo. No, I'm just kidding. That never
off
happened.
The record.
I'm just kidding. Something changed and I got sober. I don't know. I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired. The truth is, I got sober before X Supermodels. I got sober in 2000 the first time, and I stayed around for 3.5 years. So at year one, my life, I got sober. Was going to a ton of meetings, found a new way of life, thought this was great, was doing my steps, was going to a ton of meetings, was being of service, was doing everything you're supposed to do. in a 12-step program to stay sober. Year two, or, you know, after getting my first year chip, I start working on music again, which is the ex-supermodels. I start to get a lot of, you know, like, inquiries, like, he's making music. Oh, shit, let's check it out. I get a deal. The deal's about $500,000 deal. At the same time, I'm buying sneakers and collecting. My sneaker game was like at the top of the there was you could count on a couple, you know, two hands the real dudes in the game before it is what it is now. And I started to feel myself again. And then I signed to a label that was a management group, the firm who had all of these major acts. They had Limp Bizkit and Korn and Pamela Anderson and Leonardo DiCaprio and Ice Cube, and they were making their own record label, and I was one of the bands that they handpicked to start their label. Unfortunately, their idea was to get a nice little roster going, and then hopefully that like BMG or somebody bigger would come and buy them out, and then they would just do. They weren't really trying to be a record label. They were trying to make a brand and then sell it to a higher bidder. And they released two albums before the ex-Supermodels thing came out, and they both flopped for whatever reason. So mine got shelved because they were like, we're not putting out a third record. These two that we did, one was like the Backstreet Boys Girlfriend, who made an incredible record. And I think there was another one that Josh Abraham made. I think it was like the chick from a group called the Human Waste Project, who was another incredible. The records were good. They just didn't find their thing. So I was doing the ex-supermodel shit, and then at the same time the Linkin Park dude started to, you know, hit their stride. And so it was like they made that other group with Ryu after he left. And so what happened was, I could tell you what happened. I made that record. I made a lot of money for that record at the time. You know, $500,000 is not, you know, nothing to scoff at. And then the record didn't come out. And then I started getting the fuckets again. And I thought, you know, I felt like a poor me. You know, I got sober. I did the right thing. I got a record deal. And now it fucking doesn't come out. And again, going back to tying my who I am to what I do is terrible. Should never do it. Because what you do and who you are, they're not mutually exclusive in that way. You know what I mean? If I'm a janitor, I'm a fucking janitor. Uh-huh. So what? It's a good job. You know what I mean? When I come home, it doesn't mean I got to get treated like shit and looked down by whoever. You know what I mean? It's just a gig. So that applies at the top of the food scale or at the bottom. So at year three, I decided, you know what? It wasn't that bad. I only had a major methamphetamine problem, but I didn't. Drinking, how bad could it be? So I went back to drinking, thinking, you know, if it goes bad, I know I can always come back to a 12-step program. And it did not work out that way. I had another drink, and within 3 days, I was back on methamphetamines, and it took almost 3 years of a downward spiral, one that went to the depths that you just could unimaginable. How far I fell from even the original where I when I first got sober. I thought it was bad when I first got sober, this was a fucking death march. And I ended up in a warehouse off of Santa Monica Boulevard and La Brea with very little teeth in my mouth, a warrant for my arrest, suspended driver's license. My car got impounded and they auctioned it off. All my shit in a box and nowhere to turn. And a friend of mine said, man, it's fucking time you get your shit together. I had been trying for a long time. He said, I got a little spot in Beverly Hills. I'll pay your first and last, and I'll even give you money to pay your, get your license right and get you this little car. And I ran into a guy that I knew was sober, and he was going to meetings. And I don't know why that time worked when the other times I had went back and forth in that downward spiral. I couldn't hear the message anymore. But that time I got willing, and I said that prayer. There's this crazy little prayer. When it's basically God help me, and I said that prayer, and for that time God did help me. And this time the difference was is I didn't, when I first got sober, the secret was, if I just play nice and don't drink, God will give me back all the cash and prizes, you know what I mean, and restore me to insanity. This time it was like, if all I got out of sobriety was sobriety, that had to be enough, because that's probably all I was going to get. And that was enough, because my life was literally seconds and inches away from being over. I was homicidal and I was suicidal, so that was not a good combo. And I've been sober, again, a little over 15 and a half years. It hasn't been perfect. My willingness is the thing that keeps me here, and that's the only thing if you're looking to be sober. And the only thing if you're in a 12-step program that you have to do perfect is remain willing. And my willingness is never, you know, it's always been here. And be of service. And that's not easy for me, because I always feel like, you know, I come to get mine too. So I always have to make a conscious effort of getting out of my own way and showing up. And so I show up even when I don't want to, and I do the footwork to in order to stay sober. So that was the difference maker. Listen, the ex-supermodel thing, I don't know why you brought it up tonight.
I love it.
Somebody else brought it up last week, and I'm talking – everybody, a lot of people liked it, and I appreciate that. Even Cave is from Lords of Brooklyn. We talk all the time, and he was like, "Yo, you need to put that on like some streaming service or put a vinyl print." So I start, and my brother literally just sent me two CDs that he had. He lives in New York, and I give him CDs back in the day. He never lets go of them. So he just sent me two of some of the mixes. So I'm going to go through them soon and probably just
drop
for shits
shit
and giggles, release something. Yeah,
why not? You know what I mean?
So maybe that will. I dedicate to you guys and be like, yo, I'll put you on the.
Not these two fucking guys out in Jersey, son. Yo, Danny, thank you so fucking much, bro.
My pleasure.
I can speak for Rocco and myself, bro. Your vision is a huge part of our lives and many people across the world. And we just want to thank you so, so much for taking the time. And if we're ever out in Oklahoma, we're going to come visit your ass out in that fucking house, bro.
Nah, listen, as far-fetched as it sounds, you may find yourself out here one day, even just if it's just to come see the kid. You may not know this about me, but I was born in Brooklyn, spent the next couple of years in Staten Island, and we moved to California when I was six. And because of my mother being a single parent, she used to send me back, and she used to send me back to my aunt and uncles who were both in New Jersey. So I spent from 6 years old to about 14 till about the time I saw The Outsiders.
Where at?
In New Jersey. I used to be at Atlantic Highlands and Brick Township by Seaside Heights. And Perth Amboy and so I have a warm fuzzy feeling for New Jersey myself, and anytime I can get back to New York, New Jersey, I do so. So maybe I'll run into you out there and go get something to eat. But if not, come out. You know where to find me. I'll be in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, bro.
And I'll be doing the Outsiders House Museum, man.
Tell everybody out there how they can find the Outsiders House Museum and how they can find you.
Simple Google search, the Outsiders House Museum. We have a Facebook. We have a website, the Outsiders House, www.com. And the Delta Bravo thing is pretty cool as well. And then, again, look for that 2021, the new LaCobra record, and we'll see what else, man. Sobriety-wise and just in real time, one day at a time, who knows? But I really always come from a spot of believing that the best is yet to come. And even if that looks completely different of what I imagined it to be, I always have faith that, this is only the halfway mark for me. So
awesome. All right, brother.
But you're a true inspiration, and we appreciate you giving us the time, pal.
Please stay safe.
The
Please.
Great Danny boy.
I appreciate it, man. Talk soon.
That was fucking awesome, bro. Like, I not only do you get a down-to-earth dude like him, you and I looked up to that band. We look up to that band. It's still a fucking favorite of ours. And I think it was a great interview. And I'm glad he shared a lot of shit with us.
Yeah, dude. What an awesome guy. Totally passionate about what he's doing now. And he's still going to make music. I can't wait for the La Coca Nostra record of 2021.
Hell yeah, bro. So he's got the Outsiders House. He's got
Delta Bravo Urban Exploration Team.
Right? He's got that shit on Facebook. And hopefully, maybe one day, him and Everlast will fucking make a little friendship.
I have a great idea.
What?
I say we reunite them right on the Not These Two Fucking Guys podcast. What do you think?
As my mom used to say, from your mouth to God's ears. So with that being said, Rocco, please do me a favor. Do us the honor. Tell the people what they need to hear.
You're stoned too, Don. You have to be stoned too.
If
you're waiting for them to count votes, sitting on your couch with your beer belly bloat, trying to stay afloat but can't pay your car note, then you're listening to Not These Two Fucking Guys podcast.
We out.